Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. My Facebook memory popped up yesterday, and 10 years ago, yesterday or today, we started meeting here in the basement. So it's been exactly 10 years that we've been meeting down here. So we were out there for a long time, then we came back in here. So we're in chapter 10 tonight, and I would like to get through it. I know it sounds ridiculous, but I got to keep moving through this. But if we can do this, we'll only have chapter 11, 12, 13, and 14 left, which means if we do it every week, we could be done in 4 weeks with the book of Hosea. I don't want to rush through it just to get finished with it, but it would be nice to kind of keep moving. This chapter will end a subsection within the book of Hosea. This is going to be a chapter kind of wraps up the announcement that Israel's going to be destroyed. Then we've got, the next four chapters will deal with several things, but one of the main themes, at least in two of the chapters, is the restoration. God is working. Even though he disciplines Israel, sends them into dispersion, brings his wrath or his judgment, he's not finished. He continues to work. And I guess we see that throughout the Bible. Just because Adam fell, they go into this discipline. They receive the results of their sin. But God continues to work. It's no different, I suppose. The sun continues to shine, although there's a cloud over it, the sun is still shining. Although there's a cloud over Israel, they're in captivity, God is still working his plan. Everything's going to end in God's timing, in God's way, and his plan of redemption or restoration or salvation will be complete. But here with Hosea, this is the last chapter specifically identifying that it is definitely over. I'll read the NIV first, just read through the 15 verses we have, and then come back and try and go through the notes. I got some pictures kind of make it fun tonight. We got pictures to look at. Chapter 10, verse 1. Israel was a spreading vine. He brought forth fruit for himself. As his fruit increased, he built more altars. As his land prospered, he adorned his sacred stones. Their heart is deceitful, and now they must bear their guilt. The Lord will demolish their altars and destroy their sacred stones. Then they'll say, "We have no king because we did not revere the Lord. But even if we had a king, what could he do for us?" They make many promises, take false oaths, and make agreements. Therefore, lawsuits spring up like poisonous weeds in a plowed field. The people who live in Samaria fear for their calf idol of Beth-Aven, or Bethel, is its people will mourn over it, and so will its idolatrous priests, those who had rejoiced over its splendor, because it is taken from them into exile. It will be carried to Assyria as tribute for the great king. Ephraim will be disgraced. Israel will be ashamed of its wooden idols. Samaria and its king will float away like a twig on the surface of the waters. The high places of wickedness will be destroyed. It is the sin of Israel. Thorns and thistles will grow up and cover their altars. Then they will say to the mountains, "Cover us," and to the hills, "Fall on us." Since the days of Gibeah, that's the end of the book of Judges, you have sinned, O Israel, and there you have remained. Did not war overtake the evildoers in Gibeah? When I please, I will punish them. Nations will be gathered against them to put them in bonds for their double sin. Ephraim is a trained heifer that loves to thresh, so I will put a yoke on her fair neck. I will drive Ephraim, Judah must plow, and Jacob must break up the ground. Sow for yourselves righteousness. Reap the fruit of unfailing love, and break up the unplowed ground, for it is time to seek the Lord until he comes and showers righteousness on you. But you have planted wickedness, you have reaped evil, you have eaten the fruit of deception, because you have depended on your own strength and on your many warriors. The war of battle will rise against your people, so that all your fortresses will be devastated. As Shalman devastated Beth Arbel on the day of battle, when mothers were dashed to the ground with their children, thus will it happen to you, O Bethel, because your wickedness is great. When that day dawns, the king of Israel will be completely destroyed. So there it is. We've got the English Standard Version. It's pretty close. There's several verses. Remember, we started off saying Hosea was a very challenging book to translate. For us, looking at the English Standard Version or the NIV or whatever translation, those things have already been worked out. I mean, you get a nice, clean translation. They don't come to a verse and say, we don't really know what this word means. It could mean these three things. They just pick one, make the smoothest translation, and keep going. So when you read Hosea or you read Luke, you don't know what the difference is. But there are some things in here that you could go either direction with this. And so I'll try to point those things out. But did you guys, as you were following along, did you see things go different directions even in the or if you were following along, did things go, you know, different translations sometimes choose different ideas here. So anyway, here we begin. Chapter 10, verse 1 on the notes. Israel is a luxuriant vine that yields its fruit. The more his fruit increased, the more altars he built. His country improved. He improved his pillars. So basically, they are Jezreel Valley. They've got the breadbasket of Israel. And they just come off of 40 years of prosperity. But even before that, the land was still good. It was a land of milk and honey. And if it rains, things are very good. So they prospered. God put them in a place, and they were a vine that spread out. The idea here is that they're spreading out, producing fruit, or opening up as much as they could. Some translation would sound negative. If you look right here on the interlinear, vine empties Israel's fruit he brings forth. Now, again, it makes it sound that word empty is in there, so it makes it sound like the vine is spreading out and it's empty. The idea could be that they're empty, they're not producing anything, but that kind of nullifies this whole verse. So the best interpretation is it spreads out and then empties itself of its fruit, meaning it's pouring out its fruit, it's empty. It's done a good job. Well, Israel, with this, they could have taken this increase, this finances, and they could have done good things. They could have, you know, continued to worship God. Like we saw last week, they're in a trade position where they could have gone east and west, crossed the Mediterranean. They could have gone north and south. They could have spread their culture. They could have spread the knowledge of God just by expanding. But instead of doing that, the more his fruit increased, the more altars he built, the more his country improved, he improved his pillars. So instead of doing good, they took all of this and turned it into idol worship. And the two words are used is standing stones. When it says the more altars he built, you can see that is his fruit has increased the altars according to the bounty and the pillars. So if you see on the bottom of the page, one, these are pictures of Dan. Now Dan is here. Here's the Sea of Galilee. Here's the Jordan. Dan is located right here. And it's on the border of Syria's here, Lebanon's here. And this is right there in the gate, the Israelite gate. There is a Canaanite gate there at Dan that's been excavated from the time of Abraham. The Israelites covered it up and built a new gate system. They use it as a fortress or a defense system. But what you see standing right there at, as you walk into the gate, there's a series of gates that you'd walk through to get into the city. And these are pictures I took. And the first one is of a standing stone in a little place in the gate. You know, you'd walk through a couple guard towers, and then now you're in the city gate. And then the second picture is where the throne would have sat, where the judge or the king would have sat and heard the people. And I put this on Facebook. I did some labeling this week on these pictures. But where it has D labeled there, that's a bench that sat along the wall. That's where the elders would sit. It's quite a bit longer than that. Then there is, you can see the little round decorative stones. It's labeled B in that second picture. There's four of those, and that's where a wooden post, that's the base of where a wooden post would have stood, and there would have been a canopy on that. And you would have two steps up, and there would be some kind of a throne where the judge in the city gate would sit with the elders, and they'd hear cases, people would come, they'd make decisions. If it was, you know, some kind of economic decision, if it was some kind of a court case, they would hear. But standing right beside it there is C. And that, it's a stone standing up. And that is a standing stone. That would be an example of an idol. Now, sometimes the idol was decorated, carved, made out of, wood covered in gold or silver. Sometimes it was just a standing stone. And they'd come by that, it would represent the deity. And that's very, very common, standing stone. So there's two of them right there at Dan. So what it's saying is, the more you increased, the more you stood up stones to honor, and they'd come by those. When you came into the city, that's why they're in the city gate. You'd come by the stone, and those stones, you can even see the local deities in the concept. Each city was protected by a god. And so when you came into the city, if you want to have good fortune in this city, you'd pay, you know, pour out a drink offering, or you'd put some kind of a token there, and you'd recognize the god of the city because you're in their territory. They saw their gods as very territorial. And so that was there for public worship. Or a visitor would come by, they would worship. Now again, these are examples of high places. Remember Isaiah talks about it, Jeremiah talks about it. It says, you have high places on every corner. It's like, what? That means they've got a church on every corner? Or a temple on every corner? No, they've got these every place you go to appease the gods. It's paganism. Anyway, the point two on page one, the problem, Israel used their grain to go astray from their truth theology, their true ideology, and morality. They could have used all this wealth to continue to improve their knowledge, their truth, to seek after God. But instead, they had false things. With these prophets, they increased the fruit. They built more altars. And you can see those things right there. Turn the page to, and now we go down to Arad. Now we got to go to the other direction. Now we go down into Judah. And here's Galilee, Jordan, Dead Sea. Here's Jerusalem. Here's Dan we just looked at. Bethel is right here. Dan was one of the locations of one of the golden calves. You know that. Jeroboam the first, a golden calf in Bethel and in Dan. So this city that we just looked at, that was an Israelite gate built by the Israelites. I should tell you this too. But that was, I mean, that was, when that city was, you know, the tribe of Dan was supposed to settle down here by the Philistines. But they thought it was too difficult in the days of the judges. So they sent some spies out, like Moses sent spies and Joshua sent spies. So when the people of Dan got right here and they couldn't take the land from the Philistines because it was just too hard, they sent spies out to go find a new land. This was their territory that Joshua gave them. They went up here and they found a place called Lachish, and they called it Dan after themselves. And they came back and said, we found a city. It's not suspecting us. It's unprotected. They're very vulnerable. So they went up there and slaughtered the people of Lachish and moved into their city. It's a great place. There's water there. There's rivers. There's springs of water. In fact, the Jordan starts from some of the springs that come in here, fill up the Galilee, and then flow down into the Jordan into the lowest place on earth in the Dead Sea. So that's where Dan came from. So they came up from people that were too chicken to fight the Philistines to find an easier people to conquer. So they start off on a bad note. Then by the time Jeroboam splits off from David, they put their golden calf right there. So they were just, I mean, their whole time, they were in a very good place, but they continued to decline. And they're part of Israel. Now we go down to a place called Arad, right about here. And that's what you see on this. These are two examples. This is a little temple. And again, all you see is the stones that are left. It's kind of, you got to stay creative and imaginative, not fantasy-wise, but realize that they didn't live in stones any more than we live in, you know, wood, you know, or concrete. You know, we have buildings made of wood, sheetrock, you know, concrete, but we cover it up, you know. And this would have all been paneled with wood and the like and decorated. That's why the temple burned. If the temple was made out of stone, it wouldn't have burnt. It's just, but the wood was burning. Anyway, you see back there two stones that were standing stones in this temple. That's the most holy place, and you got two steps. And then they had two altars on the outside. That is where they would sprinkle incense in and some kind of fragrant offerings for the two gods. Very likely, and they found even inscriptions, probably for Yahweh and his Asherah. Yahweh and his wife. Yahweh and his female god. That they found inscriptions, and you see that. They had Baal stones and Asherah poles. And that the two gods, that's very paganized. It comes right out. God does not have a wife, but they compromised. And then those two altars there, one for each of them. Now, if you'd step back where I'm taking the picture, if I'm taking a picture right there and you just reach your hand right here, there's a big stone square altar, probably about this tall. And then even on top of it is a flat stone that they'd use to burn the meat offering. So there's right there, you can see the stone altar where they'd actually have the sacrifices. So these are probably all incense altars. Now anyway, this was so well preserved because for when they excavated, they found this, and they can tell when you're excavating because you go through layers, you know, and you dig it up and you find different layers built. You know, they have a burn layer and everything's burned, or there's a rebuild time, and you find different fragments of pottery, so you can kind of tell, you know, the layers that you're building upon. This right here, then when they found it, they could tell it wasn't excavated. They didn't need to excavate it. They just needed to remove layers of dirt. Someone buried this under dirt, like they backed up a couple dump trucks and just buried it. Says you can't use it anymore. That would mean probably around 700, right around this time. You see our chart? We're right in here, 738. I think we're right here in the days of Hoshea, right down in here, 731, when he's just assassinated Peak. We're right here in this time period. But right, this was buried, they suggest, right around 700, because what's happening in 700 and 701 is when Sennacherib, after Israel's gone in 722, Assyria continues to move down and lay siege to all of Judah, taking all their fortified cities. But Hezekiah, in preparation for this, under the leadership of Isaiah, would have probably buried this place. Or Josiah, a couple kings before Hezekiah, would have buried this after Hezekiah, in the days of Jeremiah, would have buried this site. So they all had to do is just uncover the dirt. Nonetheless, those are your two stones and standing altars. Hosea refers in point C underneath that on page 2. I've got 4 verses out of Hosea talking about standing stones and altars. I'll just read them. Chapter 3, verse 4, he's already said it. For the children of Israel shall dwell many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or pillar, and that would be a standing stone, without ephod or household gods. In other words, you're going to have no religious connections because we're going to take you away. And that continues yet today. Because they haven't got their temple rebuilt. Chapter 8, verse 11. Because Ephraim has multiplied altars in response to their sinning, they have become to him altars for sinning. So all these altars and religious activities, the more they built them, the more sinful they became. The more they built them and spent time with them, the further they got from the truth. The more they confirmed the truth confirmed the lie to be a truth. Because they were surrounding them, the children would see this, and they're all around, and the children would just assume that was true. They'd be reinforced, they'd build more altars, and now they're absolutely convinced. You can't even go up Hosea, go up there and try and explain to them. It's like, they can't. They locked them in. It's like talking to, you know, our culture. There's certain sides of our culture. It's like, you know, they've been so convinced of evolution and there's no God. And, you know, all these, you could just make the list, that their hearts are hard. They cannot hear. Chapter 10, verse 8. The high place of Avon, the sin of Israel, shall be destroyed. Thorn and thistle shall grow up on their altars, and they shall say to the mountains, cover us, and the hills fall on us. We'll get to that verse later. Chapter 12, verse 11. If there is iniquity in Gilead, that's on the other side, this is Gilead, they shall surely come to nothing. In Gilgal, they sacrifice bulls. Their altars also are like stone heaps on the furrows of the field. So all the altars that were built over here, they're not like square, sharp stone idols or you know, altars. They're heaped up and, you know, piled up because of and weeds are growing over them. That's coming up. Okay, so the next verse, chapter 10, verse 2. Their heart is false. Now they must bear their guilt. The Lord will break down their altars and destroy their pillars. So what is the problem here is they started off with a false heart, and because they've got a false heart, they rejected Yahweh, and it led them to having these altars, and more standing stones. So if they had a true heart, they would have pursued Yahweh. And they would have stayed in the light. But they've gone over here, and now they're pursuing this. And that's what you see on the next page. Their heart is false. It starts off this way. A true heart would be able to identify this, we would hope. But because their heart is false, they must bear their guilt. And their guilt is what they've produced with this false heart. On the top of page 3, I just got a little diagram like I tried to draw right there. Their false heart produced false gods and false altars. The result, false heart is guilty. The false gods and altars will be torn down. Jeremiah 17:9 says this right here, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it? And the Hebrew word here used to describe heart is halak. It can be interpreted two ways. Both should be considered possible. It can mean, and you can read about it the way it sounds, it can mean divide, their heart is divided, or their heart is smooth or slippery. And it depends on how it goes down. And then it says, because their heart is divided or false or slippery, can't hang on to it, it's not stable, they've got these, and these are going to be torn down or crushed. And the word for that, just interesting, break down, is the word harap, which means to break the neck. It's not the usual word used when God sends the Israelites in and says, tear down their gods, tear down their altars. It's the word for, it's using Exodus, Deuteronomy, Isaiah, for breaking the neck of a donkey, breaking the neck of a heifer, breaking the neck of a dog. And so it's using a word of break the neck of the altars, which is just interesting how that is used. One thing I'll point out, this last week, it's been going on for a few months in Jerusalem archaeology. Here's the old city walls, if we can say it that way. There's the Kidron Valley, Hinnom Valley. The old city of David's palace was here. Here's the Temple Mount right in here. Crucifixion takes place right here. There's the walls today. Down in this area here, the United States Embassy is right here. U.S. Embassy is right there. They're getting ready to excavate an area in this right in this place here to build some houses and just, you know, do some expansion because of the U.S. Embassy. And as they're digging here, they had to call in an archaeological team, archaeologists, to kind of approve. Yes, you can dig here. There's nothing here. But you got to kind of dig down and find stuff, take out the old buildings, you know, the more recent developments, find out what's actually underneath it before you can build something permanent. And sure enough, what they found a very large complex from the days of Hezekiah, from this very time period. And in there they found those LMLK, I mentioned this last night, that in the Hebrew, that translate that from Hebrew letters, it means belonging to the king. They take clay jars and they'd stamp them with belonging to the king and maybe have the name of the local governor on it. They found something like, I don't know, I'll say 150 of these jar handles right here with LMLK on it, meaning this was a place they collected taxes. And they came from all over Judea to pay their taxes. And one of the things we learned from this whole thing is these were the days that they were dealing with the Sennacheribs coming in, the Assyrian approaching them, and yet they still were maintaining taxation. They lost a lot of things, a lot of loss of productivity, but the taxes kept rolling in. That was one of the things they mentioned. My whole point, in this same area, they found a lot of these figurines, fertility figurines. They'd be like little idols. And they're not sure. They made this comment. They're not sure because they would find like the body part. You know, here'd be the body. You know, always have like the enlarged breast and then, you know, like this and the hips and all this. But they were all broken. And then they find the head laying somewhere else. And so, again, it appears, because this is the times of Hezekiah, they suggested in this article, while I was studying this, I had already made my notes, and then I saw that, and they say that this may have been, they may have just broke these idols, broke the necks off, broke the heads off these idols, because Hezekiah was trying to bring reform, was trying to bring this about him, or Josiah, or something. Nonetheless, that would be an example. I mean, I just saw it because I put this in the notes. The word means break the neck, but it's talking about altars, and it's like, that might be a connection. Nonetheless, chapter 10, verse 3. For now they will say, we have no king, for we do not fear the Lord, and a king, what could he do for us? So they're going to say, now he's quoting them. Now we do not know what he's meaning by, is he quoting them exactly what they're saying? Is he being sarcastic? Is he saying what they should be saying? But they say, no king, we have no king. My markers all of a sudden went dry. I'm going to walk back here. I've got one more in my bag in case this happens. I've got a little ink bottle. I found some ink that you can refill these. These are hard to find. I found them a long time ago, and then I couldn't find them for about 5 years. And I found them again. And then, you know, I would just throw them away.
but they're nice, and I didn't realize this, but you can unscrew this cut, you know, like this right here, and it's got a little sponge there, and then you just buy the ink and just squeeze it full of ink, and then put it back together and let the ink soak in, and you're good to go again. So anyway, I don't throw them away anymore. But I used to just buy them and throw them away. Okay, we have no king. They're going to say they have no king. We do not fear the Lord. And then they say, what could he do? What could a king do? Now, here's the options that, and again, we do not know exactly. It's like an email. You have no voice inflection. What is that, sarcastic? Are you serious? Is this a suggestion? Are you being critical? What do you mean by this email? So that's kind of like what we have here. And that's why I put down bottom of page 3. We do not know the tone of his voice. First, is he referring to how northern Israel became a nation when they rejected Rehoboam and the Davidic line of rulers? So right here, first of all, we got to start way in the beginning. This whole kingdom in the north began because they says, we have no king. We reject, and I've got it written down there, I think, on the next page. Yeah, right, bottom of page 3. This is what they said in Jeroboam and Rehoboam's day. When all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, see, Rehoboam was going to increase the taxes. And Israel says, please, Solomon tax us and put us in slavery. Will you release us a little bit? And remember the story. Rehoboam's talked to the older elders told him, yeah, you better listen to these people. Your father was a little overbearing. You understand? Solomon was a little overbearing in his taxation. You know why? You know this, right? Solomon, wealthy, built a big kingdom. But what he started doing, he hired the people from Tyre to come down and build. He hired and was just started spending and spending and spending and eventually overspent. I mean, he worked the nation into debt. So that he had to start taxing the people to pay off all the countries that he borrowed from and had workers from. Even the king of Hiram was upset with him because he says, I went and checked this. He said he paid the king of Phoenicia with Israelite cities. He gave him Israelite cities that was part of someone's inheritance in the land of the Lord. He gave it to him as payment. And the king went and checked the cities and came back. Hiram came back and told Solomon, he says, what is this, my brother? I mean, these are good for nothing. I mean, they're like run down, you know, they're like, you know, Chicago, Detroit, New York. It's like, this is junk. There's nothing here. And he was really upset. He got ripped off. So anyway, Solomon was oppressing the people. Rehoboam, the older guy, said, back off. These young advisors, he says, you tell them, you know the story, you tell them that my father whipped you with whips, I'm going to whip you with scorpions. You know, be a hard nose. And then they say, in response to Rehoboam, they say this. When all Israel saw the king did not listen to them, the people answered, the king, what portion do we have in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Look now to your own house, David. So Israel went to their own tents. In other words, it says, David from the tribe of Judah can be king of the tribe of Judah. The rest of us, we're going to go back to our own places. So we have no king. And by rejecting the king that God had appointed to them, the Davidic line, they had no fear of the Lord. So now they have no fear of the Lord. Now they're in northern Israel, historically, without the Davidic kingship, without the fear of the Lord. They have no temple. That's why they're spinning. They're lost. They have no king. They've got no temple. They just follow false gods and false kings that keep killing each other. Thus the chart of assassination. And then, you know, and ultimately they end up saying, the last line is, what could a king do for us anyhow? And it goes on. So here's what we've got right here. Point 2. They could be quoting this right here. Is he quoting, Hosea quoting the people because they have no king at this time? I mean, on this chart, as you see, assassinated, there's these assassinations. It could be after Pekah was assassinated by Hoshea, and they have no king. Or it could have been right down here in 724, because we're going to see, and I'll talk about it several more times, Shalmaneser comes down and takes Hoshea captive. When Hoshea goes to Egypt to the king that's called So in the text of Egypt, he goes down and gets help from him. Shalmaneser comes and just takes Hoshea captive. And so then during these years, 724 to 722, they have no king. So they have no king. and they have no fear of the Lord, and so much so that they would end up saying, even if we did have a king, what could he do for us? I mean, meaning either they never were any good, or we're so rebellious, we're in so much trouble, no one can help us now. I mean, countries can get to that place where they go, you know, I mean, it's like we're looking at an election, you know, this year. It's like, it's like who's going to turn the country around? It's like we're going to find a great, great president, and you know, assuming that the president we don't have isn't great. But it's like, okay, you get George Washington in the White House. What could he do? I mean, we're so far gone. So they may be saying our king's been taken captive. We clearly don't fear the Lord in our country. And if we did have a king, what could he do? That's one way of looking at it. And again, all those assassinations are listed. Point three, is he being sarcastic and capturing their attitude of their false heart mentioned in the previous verse? That is in rebellion towards Yahweh and the authority of the king. In this case, the people would be speaking their logic that emerges from a false heart. In other words, we don't need a king. We don't need to fear God. What good could a king do? Because we're going to do it our own way anyhow. What good do these guys do? We kill them all. In fact, you know, somebody's killing these kings. And the people that are killing these kings are the people that could be saying this. Well, we don't have a king, and we don't fear the Lord. We're going to do it our own way anyhow. And if we did have a king, that's why we kill them. What good are they? They don't do us any good. We're going to kill them anyhow. And they're going to do it their own way. And so they are, as you're going to see, in major rebellion. Also, another way of interpreting that, the term king could be used referring to two kings, which means they have rejected all authority except themselves. Yahweh, we have no king, is we don't have a God, or we don't have a human king. They don't have either one. You know, divine authority or human authority. Verse 4, chapter 10, verse 4. They utter mere words when they talk. That with empty oaths they make covenants, so judgments spring up like poisonous weeds. So they utter words. Their words are lies. You know, their oaths are false. False oaths. And so because their words are empty, they don't mean what they say, any contract they sign is false, and you put yourself in a society where words don't mean anything, and when you say, I'm going to keep my agreement, you're really not, the result is going to be chaos. Everybody's mad at everybody else. There's lawsuits. But you can't trust the court system. You can't trust the person your lawyer. Everybody's ripping each other off. So they utter mere words. This is the result of their false hearts, their false worship, their false religion, their false worldview. My words mean what I want them to mean whenever I want them to mean what I want them to mean. Children do this all the time. I mean, politicians do it all the time. I mean, and we can see in our own society. And anytime you sign a contract, you vote for a politician, they're going to do this, and they get there, that's not what they do. Eventually, that gets to the place where, well, let's just read this. Let me see what I've got here. So judgment springs up like poisonous weeds in the furrows of their field. The furrows are where, you know, the plows have gone, the seeds are planted in the furrows, and things start growing up. So in their culture, their society would be the soil, and the seeds that they planted are empty words that have no meaning because they're changing the meaning to fit their circumstances, double talk. And any kind of a contract, there's not a guarantee if we're going to break it anyhow. You're planting these seeds in the culture, and it's like a poison. It's going to grow up poisonous. And you can see the word in the interlinear. I'll read it backwards in the interlinear. They have spoken words, swearing falsely, making in a covenant, thus springs up like hemlock. In judgment, the furrows of the field. So what is coming up, these are the seeds they planted, and so what comes up out of their culture is poison. This is bad, but what it produces is poison that's going to kill the people that were planting these seeds. So it's a cycle of destruction. They lie, they break their covenants, and now they reap the harvest, and it's poison as soon as they take everybody up. I mean, it's a dead end. There's no hope for them. I write this down. This verse continues the fruit of the results of their false hearts. Their words mean nothing. False hearts produce lies and deception. Oh, well, point four is interesting on page five at the top. For example, these false oaths, they're lies and false oaths. What does that apply to? Well, we'll just walk it down. First, it starts with Yahweh. They are already considered covenant breakers. They've rebelled against Yahweh. We're going to do this, but they've lied to God. Then individual Israelites verse each other. Now they lie and use empty words with each other. You understand? There's no teams here. It's like who's on whose team? It's by the time we get done with this, it's every man for himself. I mean, again, here it is. You may have a group of people, like 50 people, come over to assassinate this king, but now these 50 guys are in this king's palace, and now they're going to start dividing. I mean, you can think of political parties. We think, no matter which political party you're on, I've got my opinions, but political parties sometimes are nothing but alignments of people for a common goal to take out this other political party. Once that mission is accomplished, they've still got to deal with each other. I think about it as like a teacher at parent teacher conferences, or if they have trouble with a child, the parents come in, and the parents, both sets of parents, maybe there's four, and then the child, they all gang up on you, and I don't have any real illustration. I can go back 30 years before I actually have a real illustration of this, because I've learned to duck. But they gang up on you, and it's like, and then you look at it, it's like, their only thing you're agreeing on is trying to get this kid out of trouble. And then you realize they've got to go home and live with each other. I mean, this kid is now, 8, 12, 14, 16, he's going to grow up in your house. I mean, he's in my class for, this period of time, but he's going to go home and live with you. It's like, okay, you can have him. We'll do it your way. And I'm done with it. And then, it's like, and the same thing there is these people, it starts off, they rebelled against Yahweh, point B, then they come against each other. I mean, they have empty words with each other, their husbands and their wives, their family members, and they make covenants, they break their covenants. Individuals within groups or political parties work to their own advantage. So as soon as they defeat somebody, they come against each other. Political parties or groups versus other political parties. Ruling government versus the people. Now, in this situation, empty words and false. I mean, you can't trust each other. You've already rebelled against Yahweh. Now you're going to trust the government who's going to tell you, this is what we're going to do. It's like, no, you're not. I mean, I know what, hey, we're in the fourth generation here. The government is lying to you. It's like, or you're talking about, you're saying conspiracy theory. I'm not even talking about America at this time. I'm talking about in the fourth generation, you can't trust anybody. It's empty words. They're lying. They're sowing it into the culture that's a fertile field to produce what's being sown, and it's going to produce hemlock, poison. So if we are in the fourth generation, based on this model, if we are in the fourth generation, your government is lying to you. Well, you have no proof. No, I have no proof. I've got a theory based on Scripture that when you get this far, the government is lying to you. Politicians are lying to you. Then, of course, it goes on, the resistance versus the ruling power. So now you got the ruling power, and all these guys got assassinated by who? People that came against the ruling power. They all got assassinated because they were in a bunker locked down because people are trying to kill me. They're like trusting people who then assassinate them. And then, watch this, here it goes. G, Israel makes an alliance with Egypt to come against Assyria. But you see right here, Hoshea the king made an alliance with Assyria to help them, but they started having to pay so much tribute that Hoshea says, I'm going to treat Assyria, and here's where the kick comes from. You can break covenant with God and lie to God. Judgment Day is coming, but not necessarily right now. You can manipulate people and lie your way through life, and you can get away with it. You can get in a political party and try to take out another political party and try and just avoid the conflict, but eventually you're going to pull one of these. And just what this may be where we come in our own culture is you've got to contract a treaty with a more powerful adversary, the Assyrians, that you need help. We need help from the Assyrians to save Hoshea and his political party and his kingdom. The Assyrians start asking for more money than they want to give. So Hoshea says, I'll do to Assyria exactly what I've done to God, to my family, to my political party, to the people I've killed to get into office. I'll just use empty words, break a contract, a treaty with them, and go to Egypt. The problem was, the Assyrians are like, yeah, no, that's not going to happen. Your friends maybe have to put up with it. Your political party has to put up with it. Your elementary classroom teacher has to put up with it. God's waiting and trying to bring you back. But the Assyrians are like, no, we're gonna wipe you out now. And that's exactly where they're at right here. They've broken covenants, and finally they've met someone that you don't lie to. You do not lie to Tiglath-Pileser. You don't lie to Shalmaneser. You don't lie to Sargon. These guys are serious. When we make a treaty, it's based on the idea that you're going to honor it, and if you don't honor it, we're strong enough that we'll just roll over and come take it from you. It's like, now God can do the same thing, but God's idea is He's graceful, He's merciful. Okay, we continue on. The main focus, point five, main focus, I think it's all said right there. And you can see I've said all those things. Here's again, this is a typical point seven on page five. Amos 5:7, same generation, same people. It's on the same chart here. Oh, you who turn justice to wormwood, or poison, hemlock, bitterness, and cast down righteousness to the earth. Amos 6:12, you have turned justice into poison and the fruit of righteousness into wormwood. The exact same thing. You're supposed to be sowing righteousness and justice into the soil of your culture and reaping a harvest of righteousness and justice. But instead, you've sown lies, falsehoods, and now you're getting poison. And again, it's reality. And that's, again, we come back to this. This is not a make-believe Christian world. This is hardcore reality. You betray and deceive people in your culture. Your whole culture becomes like that. You're going to destroy each other. Chapter 10, verse 5 on page 6. The inhabitants of Samaria tremble for the calf of Beth-Aven. Now when it says tremble, they're not trembling in fear of it, potentially. They're trembling because they're afraid of their calf god. Their calf god, Beth-Aven, is again, Beth means house, Aven means evil. It's supposed to be, and we've said, so it's Bethel, house of God. Hosea does not call it Bethel, he never does. He always calls it Beth-Aven. It's not the house of God. You've got the golden calf sitting in the house of God. It's now the house of evil. And that's throughout the book. We've seen that many times. And so, the inhabitants of Samaria tremble for the calf of Beth-Aven. Samaria is the capital. And they're trembling for it because they're fearful for the calf. They're not fearful of the calf. They're fearful for the calf. The people mourn for it. See, there it is. And so do its idolatrous priests. They don't know what they're going to do. They've now lied, broke covenant with the Assyrians, and it's like, oh no, they're going to come take our calf. Yeah, and they're like, what are we going to do now? Our kings are lying, they're manipulating, we're in trouble, the Assyrians are coming, and we're not going to be able to protect this calf. Protect their God. And then they're fine. And so do its idolatrous priests, those who rejoiced over it and over its glory, for it has departed from them. And what is saying right here? The calf was made out of wood and covered with gold or silver, and it was very glorious. And so it says right there, those who rejoiced over it and over its glory. How nice it looks. But now, it has departed from them. Where did it go? It went to Assyria. And here's pictures from the British Museum of this very time period from Tiglath-Pileser when he came down into, if we've got here, Galilee, Jordan River, like this. Up here's Dan. This is the Arameans. The Assyrians had come into Arameans during this time period here and just overran the land. And there's 55 times the Assyrians record, that's what we've got record of on their monuments, of them god-napping, where they walk off with the gods. They take the gods. 55 times it's recorded. They did it many other times. Here's one of them coming out of Aram, out of the kingdom to the north. You can see the procession. I took these pictures in the British Museum. And those are Assyrian soldiers that are going to soon be in Samaria. And those that are carrying them, those are statues. Those are not people being carried. Those are gods. We know that because, one, you look at it, it looks like, but it also is in the cuneiform inscriptions, they're carrying off the gods. And that has been taking place, and now they're in Israel at this time, they're fearful for their calf god in Beth-Aven because our statue that's in Bethel is going to be taken. The one in Dan is probably already gone because this land had been overrun by the Arameans. It was, and that was before the Assyrians, but this god's probably already gone. In fact, I forgot to tell you this. In that earlier picture on the gate, you know, where you saw the standing stones, where the judges would sit with the elders. You understand what I'm saying? Right, the pictures earlier. That is the courtyard, the gates right there, is where they found an inscription. It's called the Tel Dan inscription. Tel, it means it's an ancient city, a tel, where there's just ruins of the city. But it's basically the Dan inscription. It's a fragment. You know, it looks, you know, something like this. It's written with cuneiform on it. And right in here, it names the king that set it up. It would have been I'll think of his name in a minute. But it was one of the Aramean kings that had come down and took the land of Dan. It mentions in the Bible, and he would have set up an inscription. And on there he says that he's defeated the king of Israel, and he's defeated the king, mentions them by name, and then mentions right on there, House of David. That he defeated the king. And both the kings who went to battle, the Bible records that they went to battle together. It would be Ahab's son, and I can almost remember that guy's name. But House of David, it says House of David. It's the first time in history, archaeology, or any ancient inscription mentions David. And it's the House of David, which means a dynasty of David. And it mentions the name of the king, who's in the Bible records him as being a descendant of David. And this king of the Arameans, like the Bible says, set up a monument there after he took the city of Dan. So when you walk into the gate, before you, it's right out front of the gate, like three gates to go through. Right as you walk up there on the stone pavement, right there's a little plaque right there that says, ah, this is now controlled by the king of the Arameans. I defeated these kings and welcomed my city, and come on in, right there in the Israelite gate. So again, that's an amazing, it's one of those things that is one of the great archaeological finds, because people say, well, David was just a legend. They say David might have been, if he was real, he's just a local chieftain that legends grew up around. But now you've got an Aramean king putting up a monument mentioning the dynasty of David and defeating one of his great-great-grandsons in battle. And it's in cuneiform, written by the Arameans. And it's like, then none of us. It's just these things keep coming up. Okay, chapter 10, verse 5 talks about the calf being taken, and the people are going to mourn. They're afraid of it. It's going to depart from them, which it did. Chapter 10, verse 6, the thing itself, that's the idol, shall be carried to Assyria, Hosea says. Now, this is not history. This is Hosea telling you this is what's going to happen. As tribute to the great king. This would probably be Tiglath-Pileser, or it could be Shalmaneser V. Ephraim shall be put to shame, and Israel shall be ashamed of his idol. And what the Assyrians, when they take these gods in their writings, and you can see it in the Bible, even Sennacherib uses this logic with Hezekiah. And it's not even propaganda. The reason they're taking these idols is because, not because they don't believe in the gods, because they believe in the gods. They believe in local gods. Because you go to the city, there's the shrine, there's the standing stones, they believe in local gods. They believe they were allowed to invade the land and conquer these people, like the Assyrians defeating these Arameans, because the Arameans were not honoring their gods. If you were honoring your god, we wouldn't be able to just do this to you. So we're going to take these gods back to our country, and we will pay them respect. Meanwhile, the gods are against you, and we're against you. We're going to kill y'all. That's why they had 55 cities where they took all the gods, and they're going to now. And that's when they got back. They just got all these shrines and all these gods, because we're going to just bring them all over here, and we're going to get their blessings, because the gods would bless you if you honor them. They're like genies. You get wishes from them if you honor them. And the reason you guys are getting defeated, and that is exactly the way Sennacherib talks to Hezekiah at the wall, is like, or tells the people. Sorry, his field commander tells him. It's like, you know, we're the ones honoring God. You are the ones. And Hezekiah, if I've been reading the media correctly, Hezekiah is destroying your high places. He's covering them up. He's knocking down the statues. How? And of course, now they're getting confused between Yahweh worship and then the local gods and the local Baals. And Hezekiah was destroying all the Baal places. So Sennacherib thought, well, this is sure, there's no way you're going to be able to defeat me because you're destroying the shrines of the gods. And you know the story. Okay. Next page, 7. It says, I missed the verse. His own counsel. Oh, I see. I got that in front of him. Okay. Samaria's king shall perish like a twig on the face of the waters. That was the idols being taken away. Now the king, Samaria's king, that would be Hoshea. We're at the last king, if this is where we're at in history. Hoshea. That just means like a twig or foam. Depends on how you translate it. He's like a twig, a little piece of wood floating on it. And it's like, there's Israel's king, and he's gone. Or there's a little bit of foam stirred up in the water, and it's gone. Meaning you're going to be instantly gone. Chapter 10, verse 8. The high places of Avon, the sin of Israel, shall be destroyed. Now there, Avon, we're not saying Beth Avon. We're just saying, thou switchest, it's just evil. It's not just called evil. That would be Bethel, where the golden calf is at. The high places, or the golden calf shrines at Bethel, the sin of Israel, shall be destroyed. They're going to destroy the temple there in Bethel. Thorns and thistles shall grow up on the altars, because you know there's no city, there's no civilization. And they shall say to the mountains, cover us, and to the hills, fall on us. And this is the first time we see this in scriptures. To the mountains, cover us. We got two more times that we see this. If you flip over to page 9, there's two other places you see this in Luke. Luke chapter 23, Jesus on the way to the cross. The women are crying for him. I referred to this last week. It says, do not cry for me, for behold, the days are coming when they will say, blessed are the barren wombs that have never bore and the breasts that never nursed. Then they shall begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. For they do these things when the tree is green. What will happen when it is dry? So in Hosea, let's say 7:22 is when it's going to take place. Mountains fall on us. It's the wrath of God coming to destroy that culture. Luke 23, Jesus was prophesying, 70 AD, the wrath of God coming. He's going to destroy the culture. And then there's one more time it said, is Revelation chapter 6, verse 16, when the sixth seal is open, the throne of God appears, and the world, they run and hide and say the mountains fall on us, because now sometime in the future, when the sign of the Son of Man appears, that's when the rapture takes place. Again, we can talk about that at some point. But anyway, we got 1, 2, 3 times. Every time, it's the end of the culture. And in this case right here, it's the end of history as we know it. Now, at the next page, page 8 right there, the picture, that is Dan. I talked about the gate at Dan. Now right here, this is the golden calf shrine of Jeroboam, at Dan, up here where we saw the gate. It's on the north. It is not destroyed, because it was taken very early by the Arameans, and when the Arameans lost it, it was taken by the Assyrians. This is where that Tel Dan inscription was found, at this city. And so it continued. It just went from the Israelites into the Arameans' hands, from the Arameans' hands into the Assyrians' hands, into the deportation, and then it just continued to be used. Eventually, there's some tire building going on there. And you see, I've added the little golden calf there where it would have stood. And to the left and to the right of that golden calf, there's these stone pillars, like not pillars, but stone platforms, just like we saw where the throne sat in the gateway, where the wooden pillars would have been for the canopy over where the throne sat in the gateway. There's these stone slabs where huge pillars would have stood up. So it didn't look like this. They would have had huge pillars, like we've got pillars right here holding up the structure. They would have had a huge structure built over that golden calf. And then right out there where I've got the altar, see that altar that I've pasted in there? That's where the altar would have stood. That altar, if you don't mind, that is the altar from Beersheba, from the days of Hezekiah. And I just copied and pasted the picture in there. I took a picture of it there. But now understand, that altar was found by Avram, I think was his name, the archaeologist. And Carl Rasmussen was young when he was there. That's Carl Rasmussen standing right there on the edge of the shrine. But anyway, that altar, he was excavating Beersheba back in maybe 72. You can look it up and see it, but you can find out. And Carl was the first one there to see it assembled, and he'd forgotten his camera that day. He's always, he would have had the first picture of it. And what he found was, he found that there's four horns on it. See the four-horned altar? One of them is made, it's fabricated. The other three, he never found one of them. But the first thing he found was these cut stones that were perfect. They're like perfect stones, cut. They'd find they're being reused because someone had at some point dismantled this altar. This is in Beersheba. I'm talking about Dan. I've got a picture of the Beersheba altar here in place of where the golden calf altar was. So he kept collecting these stones that were very similar. And then he found one that had the swoop coming up, the horn on it. And then he found two more. So he found three of the horn, and he realized, this is the altar. This is the altar that Hezekiah took apart. And he reassembled it and put the last stones on. That's when Carl walked in 1972. And he says, I walked in, and he was just putting the final stones together. And he says, and that was one day I left camp without my camera. But anyway, that's another example of a high place being demolished. Anyway, that's the golden calf, and you see the drawing of what it would have looked like with the rooms and stuff imposed in that. Turn the page. There's that picture again. And there's Tony standing on the steps of that going up right there. See, I got an arrow gold, where the golden calf would have stood. Now, that is in Dan. This is talking about now in Bethel, where the other one was set up. That one appears to still be there. The one in Dan is no longer Israel's concern. It's been in Aramean's control. Now the Assyrians control it. They've lost it. But this one is still in Bethel. That's what they're referring to right here. Page 10, chapter 10, verse 9. Tick, tick, tick. From the days of Gibeah you have sinned. And this goes back to, way back to the last verses in Judges when they became very wicked. Morally wicked. I mean, raping, killing, murdering. I mean, just wicked stuff. I mean, sexual immorality. I mean, homosexuality. In Israel, in the days of Judges. From the days of Judges, you have sinned, O Israel. There they have continued. Shall not the war against the unjust overtake them in Gibeah? In other words, what happened in Gibeah? This is way back here in before the golden calf was set up. In Gibeah, in this land right here, in the land of Benjamin, they were very immoral. And so they came in, war came against them and killed just about every man except 200 Benjamites fled. But they were so immoral that war basically came in and just eliminated them. And what he's saying is, it's like the days of Gibeah. You remember what happened at Gibeah? An unjust war broke out and just slaughtered all the people. Now you're now those people. And an unjust war is going to take you out just like it did in Judges. When I please, he says, the Lord says, I will discipline them. The nations shall be gathered against them when they are bound up with their double iniquity. Now what their double iniquity could be? It could be the golden calf in Bethel, the golden calf in Dan. It could be their double iniquity, could be when they originally became a country. They forsook David, the Davidic king, and then they came up here and they rejected the temple and they rejected Yahweh. They came up here without David. There was no David. There's no royal line of David. There was no Yahweh or true Yahweh worship. They called this Yahweh worship. They created the golden calf and called it Yahweh. Same thing here. So it could be this is a double sin or the rejection of David, the kingship. That's their double sin. Ephraim was a trained calf that loved the thresh. I'm going to quit with this because this now comes up with some real good points right here. Point right here, just to close this down so we can get the chapter online. Ephraim was a trained calf that loved the thresh. Now again, train, meaning it was prepared, thresh, is the easy job of a beast of burden. They just walk around and thresh, crush the grain, and eat as much as they want to. So Ephraim was trained in a good land, and they had all everything they wanted to eat. And so it was like, we would rather have pleasure and prosperity, and that's where we'd like to just do this. And I spared their fair necks. I didn't put a heavy yoke on them. But now I will put Ephraim to the yoke. Judah must plow, and Jacob must harrow for himself. In other words, they were too focused on pleasure and prosperity and luxury, just like a cat. They love that part of the threshing. They love the eating part. But now I'm going to put a yoke on Ephraim and on Judah, and then Jacob must harrow himself, and that's talking about plowing unbroken ground. Sow for yourselves righteousness. And this is what the advice is. Sow righteousness, reap covenant faithfulness, and break up the fallow ground, the ground you have never planted, you've stopped planting on, you've left lay. I mean, you haven't been doing these good things, your lifestyle. Start doing them. It's time to seek the Lord, and He'll bring rain on this. In other words, righteousness would be with it person to person. Steadfast love is the covenant with God. And if you'll start living the way you haven't lived in the past and start doing things you've stopped doing, God will rain on you and you'll have a harvest. But instead, chapter 10, verse 13, you have plowed iniquity or planted iniquity. You have reaped injustice. And now you've got this chaos in your society. You can't turn to the Lord for rain. I mean, can America turn to God and say, God bless America with our track record? I'm not talking about our founding fathers. I'm talking about our current condition. I mean, we take God out of schools. We have abortion. Our churches are corrupt. They're more about building and collecting money. And we've got a culture. And then we say, well, God bless us. It's like, no, you've sown iniquity. You've plowed and sown lies. And now you can't turn to God, so you're going to have to turn to your own self and trust yourself and trust your military. And that's what he's saying. And it's going to now, you're going to go man versus man. Now a greater military is going to come in and crush you. You've plowed iniquity. You've reaped injustice. You've eaten the fruit of your lies because you trusted your own ways. And then gives an example of something they should be familiar with, of what it's going to be like when they are destroyed. Chapter 10, verse 15, thus it shall be done to you, O Bethel, because of your great evil. At dawn, the king of Israel shall utterly be cut off. And that is probably referring to this. At dawn, the king will be cut off. That once, watch this right here. In 7, Pekah, or Hoshea, becomes king in 731. He then rebels. And when Shalmaneser finds out about it, he comes, and before the war begins, and I've got the text written down right there at the bottom of the page. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came to attack Hoshea. Therefore, Shalmaneser seized him and put him in prison. So when Hoshea, the king, rebels and breaks covenant with Assyria, Shalmaneser comes down. First thing he does is come in and arrest Hoshea and take him in and put him in prison in Assyria. And then he lays siege to the city. And it takes 3 years for the city to fall. So when it says, thus shall be done to you, you're going to fall. Bethel's going to be destroyed because of your great evil. But at dawn, at the beginning of the battle, your king shall be taken. Israel's king will be utterly cut off. And then you've got 3 years of battle. So the king loses. I mean, he's already taken captive before the battle even begins. And then they lay siege to the city. And so that's what that chapter is saying. And I'll try to clean it up a little bit next week. Thank you for being here. I'll pray, and we're free to go. Father, we thank you again for the chance to look into your word. We ask that we would take heed to your word. We thank you for your faithfulness, that you're continuing to work out the plan of redemption, even from the beginning of time in the Garden of Eden until the final day, that you're working even now, not just in history, but even in our lives. We ask that we may grow closer to you, that we may partake of the good things you have for us in this life and in eternity, and also be a witness and bring people back. We do pray for our nation. We do pray for our churches, that we may see revival and the truth may break through the hardness of our own hearts. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time. Any questions or comments?